All right, we have two more classes before Pesach. This morning we're going to do the last chapter of the story of Avraham before the Akedah. And then next week we'll do the Haggadah. So those of you who are going into a Seder and want to refresh your memories about the Haggadah and also have some stuff to talk about, we'll be doing that next week. Chapter 21. As you recall, way back a few chapters ago, God comes to Avram and Sarah and promises them a son, even though it's very unlikely, obviously, given their ages, that they're going to have children. And Sarah laughs about it, and God reassures Sarah and Avraham that in fact they will have a son, and in chapter 21 it comes about. Vahashem pakad et Sarah. And the reason I read that in Hebrew is if you go to synagogue here on a Saturday morning, the usual Amidah, the usual prayer that we say is Magen Abraham, the shield of Abraham. But when in the last, 30 or 40 years, people included the foremothers with the forefathers in the prayers, they changed it to Magen Avraham, the shield of Abraham, Ufoked Sarah, and the rememberer of Sarah. And that's from this verse here, because it says specifically, God Pakad et Sarah, God remembered Sarah. So when they were looking for an equivalent to shield of Abraham, that's what the rabbis chose to commemorate God's care for Sarah. So God remembers Sarah as he had promised, and God did for Sarah as he had spoken. That is, God enabled Sarah to have a child. Now, by the way, for those of you who are looking for this, and I'm actually these days very sensitive to it for a reason that I'll explain in a moment, you can see that God's providing Sarah with a child is taken by Christianity as a prefiguration. Right? That means a hint beforehand of God providing whom with a child?
Mary,
right? And the Hebrew Bible is always combed for hints of the story of the New Testament. The reason that I said I'm sensitive to it is I'm reading a book by an Israeli scholar named Yuval called Two Nations in Your Womb about how Judaism and Christianity interpreted each other's traditions all through the years, and in fact, how much of the Haggadah is a reaction to the early Christian celebration of Passover, because the early celebration of Passover in Christianity was surrounded by, obviously, commemorations of Jesus. And in the Haggadah itself, this scholar is arguing, there are things that Jews say to push that interpretation away, right? Like, I will talk about this more next week, but what are the three things that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says you have to have in the Passover Seder? Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. The three things that the church made the central part of their observance of Passover. The Paschal Lamb is Jesus. The Matzah is the transubstantiation of the, and Maror, the bitterness, is the bitterness of his life, not the bitterness of Jewish slavery. And therefore, the Jewish tradition insisted these are the three things, at least according to this scholar. He believes that's why those three are emphasized above everything else. Nobody says you have to remember the karpas, right? Because spring is spring. Anyway, that's just to give a foretaste of next week. All right. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age. Okay, at the set time of which God had spoken. Now it's kind of ironic, and we'll talk about this more later, that this is the son of Abraham's old age, because you remember after Sarah dies, Abraham has a bunch more kids with Keturah, whoever she is, and we'll talk about that when we get there. But at the moment, it seems as though this is the one child that Abraham will be granted in his old age to carry on this legacy. Abraham gave his newborn son, whom Sarah had borne him, the name of Yitzchak, of Isaac. There are three patriarchs, right? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isaac is the only one whose name does not get changed. Avram becomes Avraham, right? Yaakov becomes Yisrael. Isaac remains Isaac, and the reason that the rabbis give is that Isaac is the only one who's named by God. By God. How does God name Isaac? Because God is, right, through laughter, exactly. So, and then immediately, and when Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God had commanded him. We could talk a lot about circumcision, we did last year, but I will, I'll for the moment leave it that way, but remember that Isaac is the first to be circumcised at the age of 8 days, and that circumcision is in its way, again, a prefiguration, that is a hint of what's coming. Isaac takes the knife, Abraham takes the knife to Isaac to circumcise him, and then in the next chapter, Abraham will take the knife to Isaac to sacrifice him, right, the Akedah. So everything in the Abraham story leads up to the Akedah, so it's always good to have it in mind even before we get there. And as I said, we'll spend several sessions after Passover on the Akedah because it's very, very rich. Okay. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter. Tzchok asali Elohim, which also means God played a joke on me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me, Yitzchak Li. So that's why Isaac's name is laughter, and also, as we said before, it's a rare case of laughter being named in the Bible. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would suckle children, yet I have borne a son in his old age. The child grew up and was weaned, and Abraham held a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. So, Isaac grows up, and the fact that the child is, why does Abraham hold a great feast on the day the child is weaned particularly? Any thoughts about this? Right, because he survived, exactly. Because in the ancient world, you know, children died all the time. In fact, until a child reaches the age of being circumcised, for a long time, and even today, there were Jewish laws that says that you don't hold a regular funeral for the child because it was just too common. Obviously, a situation that doesn't, thank God, obtain today, but he didn't have a feast until he was weaned. It's sort of the equivalent, it's the ancient equivalent of not telling anyone you're pregnant for the first couple of months, right? Because, you know, the day may come when people will tell immediately and they wouldn't understand why someone wouldn't tell earlier, and they'll give the same explanation that we give now, which is there was a time when you didn't know for the first few months if in fact the pregnancy would take. And it sounds strange to say it, but the same thing is true in the ancient world with a child. You didn't know for the first, I don't know how long, whether the child would live. Okay, so now we come to the conflict that sets up the conflict of the Akedah again. Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham playing, Mitzachek. Now, Mitzachek, I don't want to spend too much time with this, but Mitzachek is a word that means laughter, but it also means things that are a lot less pleasant than laughter. So, for example, in the book of Samuel, when Yoav and Avner, who are the two competing generals, when they meet over a river, they have each of their troops, I think it was 10, pull out a knife and they stab each other. That is, the troops fight hand-to-hand combat, and it's called, the troops were mitzacheking, right? So laughter and playing has the same kind of negative edge that it can sometimes have in modern English, too. When you say you're playing with me, right? That's usually not a positive connotation. And so the rabbis draw the contrast between the mitzachek that leads to Isaac and the mitzachek that leads to Yishmael. And they assume that Yishmael was doing something negative. Now, I have to say, you could make the opposite case if you wanted to. It doesn't say explicitly that anything bad is happening. The other interpretation that makes Yishmael look bad is that she saw Yishmael playing with Isaac literally. That is, they were playing together as brothers, but because she knew that Yishmael was a bad influence, and it was clear that they were going to be brothers and close, she needed to get him out of the house because she didn't want Isaac to fall under the influence of Yishmael. The other possibility is just that she sees that Yishmael is an integral part of the house, and that means that it's going to be hard to disinherit him. And she wants Isaac to be the one who inherits from Abraham, as he will inherit spiritually. She wants him to inherit materially. And this is why second marriages are so hard. It really is. I mean, the person, you go into it with many times, as you know, the person who's divorced has every intention of doing right by the children of the first. I won't say wife or husband, but it's usually the husband, right? But then gets remarried and has children, and the second spouse, wants to make sure that her children are not harmed because of the children of the first spouse, especially when the two of them are estranged. And it sets up a dynamic that nobody intends at first, but that is very, very common. Not universal, but very common. And this is the biblical equivalent, in a way. Even though Sarah was always the wife, in a way, she's the second wife now, because he's already got a child with Hagar, and now he has a child with Sarah, and the last thing she wants, of course, is for Hagar and Hagar's child to be the important ones around the house.
Would the maidservant and son inherit?
Not according to ancient Near Eastern law, but I assume, at least that's what all the commentators who investigate ancient Near Eastern law say, that the maidservant's child belongs to Sarah. So in fact, he wouldn't inherit, and it would be her choice. But I think that it's probably less clear in reality than it is in law. And I wonder, especially if Abraham isn't surrounded by a society that he's a part of, if she wonders what happens if something happens to Abraham, and there's no. I think she probably doesn't have a lot of faith that would be enforced. Ishmael is so much older. You can imagine if Avram passed away tomorrow that it wouldn't be so easy to enforce. Although, legally speaking, yes, Isaac is the one who inherits because Sarah is the legal wife. Yeah.
Yeah, I think according to the law of Hammurabi,
yep,
and the Ishtar, something, Lipset Ishtar, that if you give the maidservant her freedom, then the child can no longer inherit. Maybe that was part of God's master plan so the Arabs wouldn't have West Bank today.
I tend to be skeptical that, one second, I'm looking for the commentary. Where's that 101? I'm looking for the excursus. Where is it? Hold on one second. He doesn't have it in here. He has it elsewhere. He has an article about the, Sarna has an article, if I recall correctly, about the status of Ishmael. He says, did this status of Ishmael assure automatic inheritance rights even after the birth of Isaac? Sarah's formulation of her demand and the extreme length to which she was prepared to go point to an affirmative answer. The laws of Hammurabi and of the still early at Lipit Ishtar implicitly make inheritance rights a legal consequence of the father's acceptance of the infant as his legitimate son. There's no doubt that Ishmael was entitled to a share of Abraham's estate. The key to Sarah's demand lies in a clause of the Lipit Ishtar where it said that a father can grant freedom to the slave women and the children she's brought him, in which case they forfeit their share of paternal property. Sarah is asking Abraham to exercise that legal right. So she's pushing him out so she gets it. I don't know that, you know, you can read the Bible for contemporary situations. It's a dangerous game because it can be read in lots of different ways. I'm not sure that giving the Arab nations around, saying to them, Israel recognizes your legal right to be free, will cut much ice at the UN. But okay, it's a strategy. I mean, well, I'll leave it alone for now. But someone just sent me an article, which I suppose a bunch of you got, about the fact that the one country that was condemned for its violation of women's rights in the world was Israel. And of course, place where they practice, you know, genital mutilation, or where women can't drive or own property. Such countries were not sanctioned, but Israel was. So it's just, I mean, it's beyond contempt and beyond ludicrous, but unfortunately it's also true. All right, anyway, so she said to Abram, cast out that slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave shall not share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. The matter distressed Abraham greatly, for it concerned a son of his. Notice his, right? But not Sarah's, and Sarah has really very little, it seems, sympathy for... So Avraham is caught in a bind, and he doesn't know what to do. Yes?
Isn't this basically why there's a view today amongst the Muslims and the people?
No. Although a lot of people say that, I have to insist that that is not why. And the reason I say that it's not why is, first of all, for a good 1,000 years after this, there were no Muslims. More than 1,000, 1,500 years after. There were no Muslims until the 7th century, when Muhammad came along. So to posit a feud that with a people that didn't exist for another millennium and a half seems to me to be retrojecting back into the Bible too much. When the reason that there's a feud, there are two reasons that there's a feud. One is, you know, that when Muhammad began, he assumed, having taken a lot from the Jewish tradition, both from the Bible and also from rabbinic tradition, because if you read the Quran has some rabbinic midrashim in it that were taken from the rabbinic tradition, but he assumed that the Jews would join him. And when they didn't, there was this feud between the Jews and the Muslims that gets then enshrined in the Quran. And once a feud gets put in a holy book, just as the feud between Jews and Christians got put in the New Testament, that's a bad thing. But the fundamental reason why there is a struggle between Jews and Muslims is political and economic and land-based. Because the reason why there's no feud between Jews and Hindus is because we don't share a border and we don't share, you know, much population. And tomorrow, if Israel were relocated in Switzerland, all of a sudden you would discover that despite all the religious things, there is no feud between Muslims and Jews. Because, I mean, why do they need, you know? So I think now, having already come to this point, to the point where it's so deep and anti-Semitism runs so strong in the Muslim world, maybe there would be no uprooting it even if there were Jews in Switzerland, just like there's anti-Semitism in Japan, even though there are no Jews there. But I don't think that you can say that this action or that action alone, especially when the Quran reads the whole story differently, is why Jews and Muslims don't like each other. It's, you know, the mix of populations over history. Jews and Christians, on the other hand, the New Testament, I think, has much more to do with anti-Semitism, because there, the very birth of Christianity, which came out of Judaism, was a tremendous struggle within Judaism, but not, I don't think, so much Islam, which is why, by the way, Islam was able to treat Jews and Christians the same, basically, through history, because it wasn't based on this as much as it was based on Islam is right, other religions are wrong, they can have a second-class status and we'll treat them accordingly. But in some ways, the feud between Islam and Christianity was worse, because there was political and religious and territorial fights. You know, I mean, the Jews didn't fight the Muslims for Jerusalem because the Jews didn't have an army. It was the Christians who fought them. So, and the crusade, the whole idea of the Crusades, you know, we were just the innocent victims in the middle. Yeah.
Why didn't Muhammad think that the Jews would join him?
Because he thought he had the truth. And he incorporated the Jewish truth and their truth. I mean, think of it this way. And I've heard this argument made before, by the way. The Christians will say, we accept your truth and go beyond it. Why don't you accept ours? The Muslims will say to the Christians, we read the Hebrew Bible and we read your Bible. How come the only Bible that you won't read is our Bible? Everyone who comes later assumes that they take what is best from before and add to it. So that's what Muhammad assumed he was doing. They recognized Moses as a prophet and Jesus as a prophet, and it culminates in Muhammad. So it's called supersessionism. That is, you supersede the one before. And that's a very powerful theology. I was once actually at a conference. This is a really good answer, with David Novak. I was in the elevator with David Novak, who is a Jewish theologian and also an extremely smart guy. I don't remember if it was a Christian or a Muslim scholar who was arguing for supersessionism. He said, you know, the later you move in history and the more you understand, the greater the religious tradition, to which Novak said, then I expect tomorrow you'll be becoming a Mormon. Which was a great answer, because after all, Mormonism, you know, comes more than 1,000 years after Islam even. It's like 1,300 years. And the guy realized that it's not enough to say I came later, therefore I'm right, because there are things that came after him. We should all be Scientologists, which came after Mormonism. I was very pleased, though. I loved that. I thought that was great. Early next morning, Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped what God says to Abraham. Do not be distressed over the boy of your slave. Whatever Sarah tells you, do as she says. For it's through Isaac that offspring shall be continued for you. As for the son of the slave woman, doesn't even say her name, Ben-Amah, Ha-Amah Lagoy, I will make Lagoy Asimenu. I will make a nation of him, for he too is your seed. So God says, look, he's going to be a nation. Now, in the Bible, the nation is what? The Ishmaelites, who become a nation. But later on, of course, this got projected or whatever into Islam, who claim Ishmael as a progenitor. But God tells Abraham explicitly, do what Sarah tells you to do. Which is, by the way, the counterpoint to a very painful sentence that has caused a lot of the trouble in the story of Genesis. Which is, remember what God says to Adam about Eve? Because you did what she told you to do, I am cursing you, right? And it's clear from this sentence that it wasn't because a woman said it, it was the content of the message. Because when Sarah says something God approves of, he says, do whatever she says. When Eve said something God disapproves of, he said, because you listened to her, I'm going to curse you, right? So it's just important for us to realize that the Bible can get easily misread that way, but it's clear that God isn't saying, because you listen to a woman. It's because you listen to this woman saying this thing. Someone had their hand up. No? Okay. Yeah.
My question is, Hagar is somewhat of a victim here.
Yes.
However, by her choices, didn't she just kind of refuse to assimilate into
That is an interesting question and a really good one to bring up. That is, Manny said Hagar is a victim here, but didn't she choose not to assimilate into monotheism? Because we do know that many, that Hanefashot Asher Asu B'Charan, which is what the Torah says, the souls that Abraham and Sarah made in Haran. The rabbis are saying, how do you make souls? The souls that they made are those who converted and came with them to Israel. And it does seem that Hagar didn't, because otherwise she would be part of the Jewish people. What's that? By her own choice, right.
By choosing an Egyptian wife for her son versus...
Yes, and later on, right, she does not choose a wife from the Jewish people, and there is a burgeoning Jewish people by then. There are enough to go find someone, as Abraham does. And later on, right, she marries her son to an Egyptian and not to a Jew. I would say, you know, there... yes, that does seem to be the case. She does choose not to assimilate. It's a double-edged sword whether you assimilate to the faith of your master or not. So, you know, yes or no. But you can certainly argue that although Hagar is treated hard, it also is clear that she's, and you can say this in Sarah's favor, that when Ishmael and Isaac are playing together, she thinks he's going to influence. Please, no. Thank you, though. That she thinks he's going to influence him to be pagan, since that's the way she appears to be raising him. Okay. Which, by the way, I just want to come back to this. You know, we've talked about this before in class, but there are all these studies that argue that especially after a very young age, your peers are more powerful an influence than your parents, which makes sense because the woman who wrote this book, whose name is Judith something, Warren Harris, thank you, Judith Harris, she uses as one of the example that struck me most in reading about the book was that if you're an immigrant and your parents have an accent, you grow up speaking without an accent, even though your parents teach you the language, because you speak like your peers. You listen to the music of your peers, you dress like your peers, and this makes sense from the point of view of evolution, because after all, after a very young age, in order to survive in this world, you have to be successful with your peers, not with your parents, right? Once you reach, I mean, think of the world as it's constituted, really, once you reach the age of being able to whatever, hunt and fish, and I'm the age at which you're considered an adult in the ancient world, which is 12, 13 years old, you know, that's why bar mitzvah is when bar mitzvah is, after that point, you better make it with your peers, right? You gotta get a job, you have to have a career, you have to be able to survive. So Sarah is making a judgment here that she better make sure that Isaac's peers are what she wants. This is, by the way, one of the arguments that I always use, and I invite you to use it as well, in trying to persuade parents to send their kids to a Jewish school. Because it's your peers that will determine your value system even more than your parents. And as important as the home is, if the home is constantly contradicted by the people around you, it's very, very hard to hold on to the values of home. Okay. Let's move on, verse 14. Early next morning. By the way, this also, it's one more point. This is why Jewish summer camp is so powerful. It's really true, because that's where you see your peers. That's where you live with your peers. That's where you really get to know them. Jewish summer camp, it tends to be the most influential single thing, and that's why, because it's the one time that you actually live with people who share that system. Okay. Early next morning, Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder together with the child and sent her away. And you do have this picture of the kid, you know, on her. Now, the image of Ishmael on her shoulder is a funny one considering the fact that, you know, he's a teenager by now. But the story itself depicts him as a child, doesn't depict him as a teenager, just as the Akedah depicts Isaac as very young, even though if you follow the biblical chronology, he's already in his 30s. Yeah.
Maybe like a metaphor of putting the responsibility on
the shoulder. Yeah, I think that that's right. The shoulder from long ago is a metaphor for bearing the world like Atlas, you know, bears the cosmos on his shoulders. She wandered about the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water was gone from the skin, she left the child under one of the bushes and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away. Now, again, bow shot is going to presage his career, his life, right? He's going to be a man of a hunter as his ancestors. For she thought, let me not look on as the child dies. And sitting thus afar, she burst into tears. So it's clear, by the way, that the Bible is extremely sympathetic to Hagar and to Ishmael. It's a strange thing because we think of God and the narrator of the Bible as the same, right? It's God who's writing the book and sometimes speaks about God in the third person, right? God did this and this and this, but we think about God as right. But sometimes the perspective of God and the perspective of the narrator seem to be different. Because here God is saying, send him away. And the narrator is showing us how tragic what happens is to Hagar and to Ishmael. But then it brings it back together again because God is about to send an angel. So we realize that the sympathies are really God's sympathies, even though there is this strange split. You know, when you talk about yourself in the third person, it's almost like God isn't in this. Because once she bursts into tears, it says, God heard the cry of the boy, and an angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy where he is. An angel often does God's work in the Bible. An angel, remember, announced the birth to Abraham and Sarah. And an angel in the Bible is basically a functionary, a tool. An angel doesn't have an independent will until the very end of the Bible, when there are angels that seem to serve as a sort of loyal opposition, even though they can't do anything that God doesn't permit. But here, an angel is effectively God's messenger, which is what the word malach means. And it says, God has heeded the cry of the boy ba'asher hu sham, where he is. The rabbis interpreting that phrase, which seems superfluous. Why do we have to say where he is? They say that even though later Yishmael would trouble the Jewish people, which he will, which goes back to what you asked before, God judges people where they are now, not where they may one day be. So he saves Yishmael. It may be true that later in history it'll be a problem, but right now Yishmael is just a boy in trouble. The end, yeah. Na'ar. Yelet is a boy and Na'ar is a youth. So I don't know. I mean, Na'ar is an older Yishmael than a Yelet. I don't know why in the first place it's used Yelet and the second Na'ar. I don't remember any commentary on that, although I wouldn't be surprised if there is. What's that? Yeah, did it say something? I can't hear.
Maybe that's why she can't carry her on her.
Yeah, yeah.
Carrying him on her shoulder because
he's a Yelet. A Yelet, but how does he turn into a Na'ar all of a sudden? Yeah, yes. You know, in puberty they grow really fast. Yes. Yes.
In which case, how is it interpreted?
Well, I'm glad. If you remember last year, I was going to call, and I did call Reuven Firestone, and he was in Egypt. So I'm going to call him this year because he's back, and see if we can get him to come and explain, since he's an expert in this, the Islamic traditions about Abraham and Isaac and the Akedah. So you remind me to call him, and I will. And rather than my giving you a very inadequate account, let's get him to give a full one, since that's his expertise. And also, I'd be curious to know what the last year was like in Egypt for him.
Kevin?
Yeah, sure.
In the book, that maybe the journey that Hagar took was to kind of made them more mature.
Well, it depends. I mean, it's possible that the journey they took made them more mature. It's also true, again and again, that the rabbis say ein mukdam u'muchar b'Torah, which means there's no early and late in the Torah. What they mean by that is the Torah doesn't follow chronological order. It just doesn't. Some commentators try to force it into chronological order, but there are stories that insert themselves in other stories. There are jumps in time where younger people seem older, and it's almost, the mode of storytelling is, in a way, is not perfectly linear. It doesn't go from, you know, a beginning, middle, and an end, which is what we all want in our stories. It is more conversational. Oh, and by the way, did I mention, while that was happening, or before that happened, that this and this and this happened, it's almost like a montage. So it could be that there's a longer story. It's not just they got thrown out into the desert. It was a day, and then, you know, he was going to die. Maybe it was much longer than that. The Torah doesn't feel the need so much to give us the time as it does to give us the...
And not so much time, but the experience.
The experience of it, right.
It could have been an hour, but the...
It's possible.
Being thrown out
would certainly change you. Right. I think that it's an unfortunate but true truism of psychology that you grow more from painful experiences than happy ones. And this is, you know, it can also distort who you are and how you are, but if you manage to make your way through it, it can grow you in powerful ways. And maybe that's what's happening here with Yishmael, is the experience of being thrown out of his home and having his mother thrown out of the home, which you can imagine must have embittered him. Maybe it matured him. Maybe. And by the way, the fact that he's still under God's care, because though, you know, do you know the psalm, even though my mother and father forsake me, God will gather me in, which is the psalmist's reflection on an experience like this. That is, you can be forsaken by human beings, but that doesn't mean you're forsaken by God. God heard the cry of the boy, and an angel called to heaven and said, "What troubles you? Fear not. God's heeded the cry of the boy where he is. Come, lift the boy and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him," which is a beautiful... Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And here again, it doesn't say God put a well of water there. It said that God allowed her to see it. So this could go back to the same thing, which is that the experience matured her to the point where she finally could see the possibilities of life around her. Even though initially when something terrible happens, what do we think? The whole world is collapsed. Everything is awful. It's only later that it unfolds whatever possibilities it has in it. And here she sees the water. She fills the skin with water and let the boy drink. God was with the boy and he grew up. He dwelt in the wilderness and became a bowman, right? Which was hinted earlier. He was a bow shot away and he becomes a hunter. Again, this also confirms what Sarah saw in Ishmael and Isaac. She didn't want her son to grow up with an older brother who's a hunter, especially when older brothers are such powerful role models. She wanted something else for Isaac.
But Rabbi, you said earlier that he married an Egyptian.
He will. He will. Yeah, he hasn't yet.
History shows that Jews became a slave in Egypt.
Yes.
So is that related to what happened?
It could be as well. Not that the Ishmaelites enslaved them, but later on the Ishmaelites will be responsible for selling Joseph. The Ishmaelites and the Midianites together are responsible for selling Joseph to Egypt. So it does tie in that way. Yes. At that time, Avimelech and Phicol, and this is the last story before the Akedah, chief of his troops said to Abraham, "God's with you in everything you do. Therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my kith and kin, but will deal loyally with me in the land I've sojourned as I've dealt with you." And Abraham said, "I swear it." We talked more about this again last year, and I'm not going to go over, there's a lot in this story as well, but let's just read it and get some of the major points. Then Abraham reproached Avimelech for the well of water which the servants of Avimelech had seized. Again, it ties into the well of water. Hagar sees a well of water. Remember that water is everything in the ancient world, right? If you don't have water, you can't live, and you can't turn on the tap. You have to find a well. And the ownership of wells was critical. But Avimelech said, "I don't know who did this. You didn't tell me, nor have I heard of it till this day." So this is a very funny way of protesting, right? When it's, you know, the kid who says, "I didn't know anything about the cookie, and besides, I didn't take it, and it's long before dinner anyway." So Avimelech is saying the same sort of thing, right? "I don't know who did it. You didn't tell me about it, and I haven't heard of it till today." So who knows what, I assume that it was not uncommon in the ancient world to poach and then deny. But Avraham takes oxen and sheep, gives them to Avimelech, and the two of them make a pact, right? This ties them together. And Avimelech said to Abraham, "What mean these seven ewes which you've set apart?" He replied, "You've accepted these seven ewes for me as proof that I dug this well." That is, you take something, taking something in the ancient world, this goes back to the ketubah. In a ketubah, there, in the ancient world, you have to actually, to solidify an agreement, one person takes something from the other. And then the witnesses sign, "I saw you take this animal in testimony to the fact that the well is yours or the other person's." So when you sign a ketubah, not in every tradition, but in the Ashkenazi tradition, you take a handkerchief, which symbolizes you're taking the obligations in the ketubah. There isn't any paperwork. There's no contract. The only way that you can prove that somebody did something is to have witnesses who say, yes, they did it. Right, because you don't have files and computer files and city hall and all of that until later on in the tradition when the ketubah gets developed in the ancient world. There's very writing is scarce and expensive, so for example the Bible does not mention a marriage contract but does mention a contract of divorce. And why would that be? because you don't have to argue about whether someone's married, but if you want to marry someone, you have to prove that they've been divorced, if they were married once, right? So the and I assume that it's related in part to the scarcity of written materials, is that you only had, you only wrote when you absolutely had to.
Yeah.
Yes, right, and then cut. But that's another, that's a whole nother, right. So hence that place was called Be'er Sheva, for there the two of them swore an oath. A Be'er is a well and Sheva is seven. When they concluded the pact at Be'er Sheva, Avimelech and Phicol, chief of his troops, departed and returned to the land of the Philistines. Notice that Avimelech doesn't go alone to meet with Abraham, right? He goes with his, with the chief of staff or the general. Avram placed a tamarisk at Be'er Sheva and invoked there the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham resided in the land of the Philistines a long time, Yamim Rabim. So, first of all, Avraham and Avimelech, each of those names in this story occur seven times. There are seven ulams. The verb to swear and the verb Be'er Sheva came from the same Hebrew root as seven. So it's a very artfully put together story, and I think that it suggests, in a way, that everything in Abraham's life is set. It's all fine. It's all patterned. It's all good. And now, of course, it's all about to blow apart because we're on the cusp of the Akedah. But now Abraham's life is exactly what God promised. He has an offspring who's going to fulfill the promise. Sarah has had a child. He has material wealth and peace and stability, which is what this dispute with Avraham and Phicol is about. You know, when a king comes to you and you negotiate a pact with him, you must have a lot of sway, because otherwise the king would just take whatever he wants, which is what kings did in the ancient world. But Abraham is powerful enough to negotiate a pact with Avimelech to their apparently mutual satisfaction, and powerful enough to live among the Philistines with no trouble. I don't know if any of you saw in the New York Times a week or two ago, there was an article about the Philistines. They have started to excavate more along the coast, and they discover how sophisticated a civilization the Philistines had. You know, we sort of assumed that the Israelites were the only, you know, I don't know, the only professors that moved into the land. But the Philistines, who were a seafaring, obviously, because they were on the coast, they were a seafaring civilization, but they found some writing from them and so on. And this is a hint of it. The hard part about reading the Bible, one of the hard parts about reading the Bible, is that the original readers knew so much that we don't know anymore. When they said Abraham dwelt with the Philistines, they all knew who the Philistines were and what they were like and what it meant to dwell with the Philistines. It would be like I told you, and he went up to Canada. And you would have some sense of what that means to go up to Canada. But 2,000 years from now, if you know, you say, and he migrated to Canada and lived there for 10 years, they're not going to know what Canada was. And we have that problem too, and excavation is of course just a small taste. But it does seem that the Philistines had a fairly advanced civilization and lived in Israel until the time of David and Solomon, which is, you know, more than a millennium after, or now almost a millennium after Avraham, 600-700 years after Avraham's time. So that was a fairly long-lived civilization, because we don't know how long they were there before Abraham. They, in the course of Israel settling the land of Israel, they came into constant conflict with the Philistines, who were finally defeated and probably absorbed, and they went the way of all the other nations all the seven nations that are mentioned in the Bible as having inhabited the land of Israel, they're all gone, as are most of the nations of the ancient world. Are Philistines? This is an argument that, you know, I have not read anything that convinces me that contemporary Palestinians have any connection to the Philistines. But it's very, ancient connections are very hard to disprove. I mean, how do you disprove them? How do you say, no, there isn't a continuous chain of tradition in this or that land? So, but I don't see any cultural continuity, and at least archaeologically, I'm not aware of any continuity, although there I do have a book that claims that, and happy to lend it to you if you want it. So, no, I'm not aware of it. I mean, the Bible doesn't mention the Philistines after David and Solomon. So, and that's David's great accomplishment, is wiping out the Philistines. And you've got to presume, since they didn't know yet that there would be Palestinians in the 20th century, you've got to presume that if the Philistines still existed, you would hear about them after the time of David and Solomon, and we don't. So, but of course, that's not going to convince the fact. You can't say to somebody, you know, well, they're not mentioned in the Bible. That's not going to convince someone who doesn't see the Bible as anything other than a tool of propaganda. So, other questions or comments? Yeah.
You said that his life is set. Is that one of the reasons why we read the Akedah for Rosh Hashanah?
Well, you read the Akedah for, we'll talk about that in more detail, but you read the Akedah for Rosh Hashanah because it emphasizes the themes of judgment, of salvation, of all those things, and also because the God's preserving the Jewish people and allowing them to flourish is a central theme of the holiday. But we'll talk much more about that when we get to the Akedah, which over Passover I encourage you to read, although obviously we're going to read it again when we get here. But if you want to bring in any commentary, we're going to go over it several times with several different commentaries, both Jewish and also one particular Christian commentary, that of Kierkegaard. However, for next time, I have a whole bunch of Haggadahs sent to me by Ralph's that I will bring us all. I'm not kidding. They send a big box of Haggadahs, and I don't know what to do with them all. But I'll bring a whole, what's that, if you need some, I'm serious, I'm going to bring a whole bunch of Haggadahs next time for us to go over the Haggadah together, and you are welcome to take some of the extras home with you. Yes? Sure. What's that? In modern, yes, that's what the article was about. In modern English, to say a Philistine is to call someone unlearned. It's a modern usage. I don't know what the origin of it is. I mean, it's obviously biblical, and it came through English language. I don't know where it came from. I'll have to look upstairs. I have the Oxford English Dictionary, which gives you the English origins of, but the whole article was we're being unfair to the Philistines by calling, you know, unlearned people Philistines. Yeah. Because Avimelech was a king. I think that's why. I think you can't say to a king, this is mine. Instead, what you say is, here's your tribute so that you will acknowledge that this is mine. I think that's what's going on. That's my sense, right? Because Abraham is clearly being diplomatic by giving away, even if it's a token, I don't know how much seven lambs means to Abraham. He's a wealthy man. But still, by giving away something, he's being diplomatic because he's giving away something for... This is a truism of diplomacy that is hard for people to accept. But anytime someone makes a claim internationally, or for that matter, even among people, the person against whom the claim is being made almost always has to give something up, even if they're right, just to pacify the situation. It's very rare you can get away with, I'm 100% right and have to give you nothing to satisfy your claim. So I think that's what's happening, but even so, I think that Avimelech would take whatever he wanted and the well if Abraham wasn't a formidable adversary. And we know he is from the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings, where he made the difference in the war, which is earlier in our story. All right, so for next time, I will bring you Haggadahs, and if you have any questions about the Haggadah, please bring them, and if I can answer them, I will. And thank you.